Buddhist Summer School, Sunday afternoon, 3rd September 1978. There are three questions here, all related to the subject of samadhi. Yesterday you were talking about meditation and samadhi. You mentioned analytical split-up consciousness and whole or holy consciousness. Can the first be equated with meditation and the second with samadhi? We can answer the second part of that question quickest of all. If consciousness is whole, complete, total, attentiveness is total, and then that is the state of samadhi. When attentiveness is total, it is no longer subject to the limitation of time particularly. It is in the immediate moment, and if the whole consciousness is constantly in the immediate moment, then there is no awareness of the passage of time. But I use the word constantly. This is for the sake of explanation. This constancy is not a constancy in terms of time. It is not a measurable constancy. It's the constancy of absolute be-ness, of being. You see? And in this state, you are actually functioning in the dimension of eternity, which remains immeasurable. It is only afterwards, when you come back to ordinary sense, discursive mind consciousness, if the impress of that experience of samadhi has been sufficiently powerful, and you have that kind of intellectual ability and gift to let it come out in concepts and words which are as little misleading as possible, then you realize, you can say that this was an experience of or in eternity. And that is the true meditative state. And the Buddha himself says to Aggivesana, in one of the discourses, "And I constantly abide in the state of the Shunyata Phala Samadhi, the samadhi which is the fruit of the realization of complete emptiness of the psyche. No interference, therefore, with the activity and functioning of universal mind." That energy, that form of energy, of the creative energy which produces everything ultimately. Mind is the name for that form of energy which releases cosmos out of primordial chaos, the state of vibrant quiescence, undergoes a change and limited particulars come into being to manifest the entire cosmos. That is one of the reasons why it is said that the Holy Ones are omniscient. They are omniscient in that sense, not in any encyclopedic sense whatsoever. You see? This is the all-knowing. You know how, for example, in the Upanishads, you have a wonderful presentation of this. Brahman is Sat, Chit, Ananda. Chit is usually translated as being, consciousness, bliss. It would be better to translate it as being, total attentiveness, bliss. That is why also in the Bible, not a sparrow falleth to the ground, but my Father in heaven knoweth it. It's only in that sense. So that is the state of samadhi. And when samadhi becomes the natural state for you or me or any single human being, natural and spontaneous, you see, otherwise the Buddha or the other holy ones wouldn't have talked about it and say you'll attain, you can realize samadhi. When it becomes a natural state, then we have reached, the individual is the manifestation of the perfected human. Because the root man in Sanskrit, which is in the dictionary always given as meaning to think, but it's not discursive thinking, it's the thought, it's, if we use the word thought in inverted commas, it's that power of thought which creates the universe. So that, yes, that whole or holy consciousness is the state of samadhi. Analytical split-up consciousness, we can up to a point equate it with the word meditation, especially since in the English language, in the dictionary, meditation is one of the first definitions given is musing. And when you are musing, particularly if you are musing deliberately, you have a succession of thoughts, an activity of the mind, which is trying to find out something by processes of logical deduction or by inductive inferential processes. You see, either building up from the particular to the general or from the observation of many facts of the same type, deducing a principle or something like that. Also, this analytical process is one in which specific subjects are examined. So in that sense, alright, you can use the word meditation, and it is an analytical process. But as far as our daily functioning is concerned, our consciousness is always a humble jumble split up. An analytical thing which is a real humble jumble. It's a confused state. Whereas when you deliberately work at it, it's a steady state. It is dealing with something which is meaningful. Through the intellectual techniques, this is the second part of it, that is the analytical split-up consciousness, of mindfulness and meditation, and through the practical daily practice of sila, does one gradually grow into a condition of more or less continuing state of samadhi. I shouldn't say that you grow into a condition of continuing state of samadhi through intellectual techniques. The intellectual techniques as such are specifically helpful in developing our power of concentrating attention upon that which at the moment in the circumstance needs to be attended to. Your mind doesn't wander, as we say. Supposing you have some important business to see through, and it's got to be all done by 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Well, you pay full attention to that. You concentrate your attention exclusively upon that. as far as you can concentrate it exclusively, keeping out everything that interferes with that particular topic or subject, you see. So you develop your power of concentration. One of the great values of developing the power of concentration that is that you can develop the power of thinking in a manner which is coherent. You see, the incoherence aspect disappears with the power to concentrate attention upon this, that or the other specific topic as such. But it never will lead to samadhi, which belongs to a dimension of being and consciousness, which utterly transcends all the this dimension of being and consciousness, in which all analytical work is done, all discursive thinking is done, all inferential thinking is done, and so forth. You see? How important, this is the third part, is the blinding flash type of experience, and what relation does it have to samadhi? The blinding flash type of experience has very great value in lightening up and enlightening your sensitivity, your mental sensitivity in this, that or the other direction. Your blinding flash is a flash. It's a particular thing. It's a limited thing. You see? And so it still is within the realm of the confined. And your blinding flash will always be associated with the emergence of an inspiring idea or a motivation or something like that. But it belongs to the realm of the particular, the limited. This is your blinding flash. The state of samadhi is the constant, natural, spontaneous condition of being, just as your body is alive and will continue to be alive until it dies, you see. So it is like that. It's a living thing and a whole thing, a total thing. You don't need to be conscious of it. The fact is there. Now, the blinding flash lightens up something where previously there was some uncertainty or inconclusiveness or something which was not sufficiently clear-sighted. So the clear-sightedness comes with respect to that. But do remember, don't therefore feel, oh, now I've had my minor satori or whatever you like to call it, and cling to the impress of that momentary flash or satori for the rest of your days. This is the final truth, not a bit of it. There is no final truth in that sense. So, it is very important. It enables you to see things very clearly, but realize that it will have its spell, it will have its period, and then become outworn. Otherwise it means that you're stuck with just that degree of clear-sightedness. You don't grow any further. It's a very good question, very good set of questions. And here is another very good question. You said yesterday that all methods of meditation have to be put aside before the true meditative state can function freely and naturally. Now the question comes, can any method of meditation be helpful in developing mindfulness and in living the religious life? Or are all methods a hindrance to the true state of meditation? I shouldn't go so far as to say that all methods positively and constantly are a hindrance to the supervening, that is the best way to look at it, the supervening of the true meditative state, the state of samadhi. Now, any method of meditation is helpful in developing mindfulness, because the element of concentration in the sense of being aware is encouraged. It is made to grow. As you know, mindfulness plays the most important part in Satipatthana, in the releasing of oneself out of the state of dukkha. And in order to make the best use of meditation of that sort, one can utilize the sect meditations to develop your power of concentration. In concentration, you are awake to a particular thing, a deliberately chosen particular something. But in true mindfulness at all, that is applied to the whole of life generally. You are mindful, say you're walking along, you are mindful not only of that particular tree there, or the grass, or the people around, or the singing of the birds, or whatever it is. You are mindful totally as possible. That is to say, you do not shut off the sense avenues. All sense avenues are there, functioning. And because your power of attentiveness is growing through any practice, meditative practice, which increases your power of attentiveness, therefore it is certainly helpful in living the religious life. Because you remain mindful, remaining mindful like that, mindful in the right way, not in the spirit of being on guard against this, that or the other, but of being wholly observant of whatever is there, pleasant, unpleasant, good, bad, whatever it may be. You are mindful of that without any sort of condemnation, without any sort of praise, without taking sides or expressing any sort of preferential choice. This is the outstanding aspect of mindfulness in the true sense, the great sense. You do not react, in other words. You know, in the opening of the Brahmajala Sutta, there is a remarkably good example. Two bhikkhus were walking along. Two people were walking along. One was speaking against the Buddha's teaching, other was speaking for the Buddha's teaching. And then the monks go to the Buddha, and the Buddha points out, no sides must be taken. If a person speaks against the Dhamma or something, and you know that it is not true, just point out that such and such is the truth of the matter, without feeling any aversion or antagonism towards the person. This is the truth of the matter. And if anybody is, and there's no need, therefore, to spread aversion. And if it is true, then you just say, yes, according to the teaching of the Lord, this is so. See, and you don't have any elation in yourself in consequence, or you're taking sides with the person who's speaking the truth against any person who is speaking the untruth. Now you see, this is where one of the very profound aspects of the teaching on love in Buddhism comes in terms of upekha. You know, the four aspects, metta, karuna, mudita, and the last upekha, whose first meaning is indifference. But it's not indifference in our ordinary English sense of the word at all. It is the condition of imperturbability. This is what upekha is. It's the condition of perfect dynamic poise, not a static poise. Because if there is a static poise, your mind is fossilized with set ideas and beliefs and so forth. It's a dynamic poise, always ready to grow. But the poise is so powerful and at the same time so delicate that you see the whole situation in its full content and are not upset or swayed one way or the other. It is in this condition that it is possible for any person truly to consider together with any other person or persons any particular problem that comes up, any particular discord that may be present, and so forth. And if this kind of upekha is developed within oneself, has come to fruition, then the extraordinary thing which you discover is this, that associated with it is compassion in its transcendence. This compassion is not the same as pity. In pity there is a certain condescension. This must be understood. It is a compassion that is not going to be upset by the sight of evil or wrong or the experiencing of any hurt or anything. There will be nothing but this transcendent, unimaginable, unthinkable, nondescript thing which is transcendent love. It is the love, in theistic terms, and I don't think that the followers of the theistic religions appreciate the point at all. The thing which the theists call the love of God for the totality of creation. If we speak in human terms, God knows that He has created the devils and the evil things and so forth. If one really sees that, all the miserable tomes which have been written and the oceans of ink spilled on acres of paper to solve the problem of good and evil and so forth, all that will disappear. There is no problem. The construction dissolution, the pleasant, the unpleasant, everything is there in totality, in its place, in its right place, performing its right function. And this is one of the profound meanings of love. Love includes everything. If this is not there, then love cannot heal. See, it's a very deep and a very extraordinary thing altogether. It's very hard to live up to. It's a superhuman achievement on the part of holy ones that they are able to live up to that. Therefore, out of their psyche, there never goes out any reaction of hate or jealousy, of anger, of envy, of disappointment, or any such reaction, nor of praise or taking sides with what is liked or good or thought to be good and so forth. None of the partial, tainted, dualistic values which fill our ordinary everyday life have any place in that transcendent valuation? Those of you who have looked into chapter 17, I think, in the heart of religion, the chapter entitled Virtue, Mind, Psyche and Karma, we'll find just the first 3 pages or so trying to present this vision of what virtue is. Virtue really is soul strength, virtus, the strength of the man. And what is man but the creative thinker in ultimateness? And this power, this strength of the soul, of the creative thinker, is the, as far as I can see, the fundamental meaning of virtue. Now you see what a distance our dualistic good, bad, kind, cruel, honest, dishonest dualisms are. They are pretty hopeless. It is that transcendent virtue from which derives our moral imperative. Way back in the Rig Veda, those great seers, the poet seers of the Vedic age, they presented this virtue in terms of Varuna, who is the Lord, is the God of the universe, as the moral governor of the universe. In using language, they have to use the word moral. And so we get this moralistic bias attached to virtue. But that is not the true thing. It's this virtue which is absolute. So then, all methods of meditation, a hindrance to the true state. No, not if one can utilize them and approach them in the right, with the right understanding, in the right spirit. You see, this is very important. Approach them in the right spirit, in the right way, and realize that they are but tools to enable your power of attentiveness to grow. And then you discard the tools when they are no longer necessary. If you just stick on to the tools for the next 542 years of your life, well, you'll just be at the same point as you were 542 years ago at the end of your life. You see, don't let the tools burden you. You know that wonderful parable of the raft which the Buddha presents. That is one example. But of course it's sometimes misinterpreted, just as the same sort of teaching in the Upanishads has been hopelessly misinterpreted by some of the greatest Christian theologians who have translated the Upanishads and written treatises upon the philosophy of the Upanishads. When dealing with the moral section, they talk of going beyond good and evil as, well, you can do jolly well what you like and it doesn't matter. Absolute contrary. Now, mindfulness meditation, where one sits for a certain time each day, attempting to be mindful of all thoughts and feelings as they arise and pass away. This is quite a valuable practice, to do it in the quiet, in the silence. But as the thoughts arise, just watch them and let the psyche, whilst being as observant as possible, be so quiet and so still that these thoughts and feelings will yield up their message to you. Otherwise, you're just looking at something with a sort of almost as if with a senseless stare, instead of a true seeing. The point about watching the flow of thoughts and feelings as they arise and pass away is simply this, that you really see what they are in themselves, in their actuality, and one learns many, many lessons out of all that process within oneself. Otherwise, it just becomes a jolly old routine. Off we go to school at 10 o'clock, we finish at 4 o'clock, and then we rush home. We go to school very, very slowly. When the bell rings at the end, we run back home or onto the playing field. It'll become that sort of thing, which is not specially mature or adult. It's rather childish. So do understand how you should watch the feelings and thoughts as they arise. And all that is certainly helpful. And of course it does help in promoting mindfulness. There comes the point, as the climax of it all, that when mindfulness has arrived at its perfection, it is identical with the state of samadhi. What is samadhi but a state of complete mindfulness at a transcendental level? This is the point. But don't think of the transcendental as something separate from, different from this here and now. It is the same world, the same total world of which you are mindful in the state of samadhi, the transcendental state. And this total world here, with its dualisms and its multiplicity, is wholly subsumed in that transcendental dimension.